Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Flynn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's the Need to Know podcast, all thanks to Rode Microphones. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, NGK Podcast, and online at podcasts.needtoknow.cloud.
We're back for another Need to Know episode. My name is Robert Crane. This is episode 193, and somewhere on the other side of the microphone is my co-host, Brenton Johnson. Welcome, Brenton.
Good to be back, Robert. Thanks for having me.
We're back again, and we've got some more news and updates and some other additions that have transpired since Ignite. So hopefully people got a nice update on our two Ignite sessions, and they're now more or less got more information about what Microsoft's planning in the next 12 months. And again, one of the things I'm doing is making that available on my GitHub repository, so you can go in and have a look at those links that are now being posted up to YouTube, and I'll share that link in our show notes. But again, a whole year's worth of content there. All right, Brenton, what else has been happening on your side of the fence?
What's been happening now? So post-Ignite, so Ignite finished last month, and we did a couple of podcasts there. Just basically running around trying to get people into Office 365 has been pretty big for hardware this month and pretty big for migrations. Would you believe there's still people, accounting firms, etc., who run MYOB, and MYOB's told them not to move to Office 365 for a number of years, and now they're basically saying you need to move to Office 365. So that's a good move. So a lot of accountants out there still on-prem need to move to the cloud, so we're working on those sorts of projects at the moment. How about yourself?
Yes, in the middle of a very busy month, I've just come back from Adelaide and Perth doing a Microsoft 365 workshop there, workshops in those two capital cities. Also going to Lismore basically tomorrow and doing training there, and then the week after, and the week after, and the week after. So yeah, right in the middle of big travel season for me, lots of demos, updates, presentations, and so on for the month. So hopefully racking up those frequent flyer miles, but it is very tiring. And again, I do certainly feel I'm not as productive when I'm sitting at my desk, but we have to soldier on, don't we?
Oh, that's right. And it's good that you go out to all these places, Robert. You could probably make a good business for yourself never leaving Sydney, but you do choose to come down and visit us in Victoria or go over all over Australia to help us out. So it's good that you do that.
I'm working on a bot that'll do it for me, let me assure you.
You need a robot, Robert.
An army of drones, I think, is probably what... once I get the battery life long enough to fly down there, then we're all good to go.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, so I suppose one of the biggest things there that has changed since we last spoke is that Microsoft has taken back its Windows 10 update and now pushed it out again. So I think you've got some ideas or some news on this, haven't you, Brenton?
Yeah, this was a bit of a freak accident, I think. I don't think anyone sort of thought this would happen. The impact was that files were getting deleted. And then when you upgrade to 1809, I think you had to force it with the upgrade tool. I don't think it was doing it automatically for most users. You'd spin up Windows again, and you find all my documents files had disappeared. So to be clear, this wasn't affecting everybody. This was only affecting a few people, to the point it was 0.01% of users. That's it. And it's not just 0.01 of all Microsoft Windows 10 users, it was 0.01 of the people who downloaded and installed the update. So it was a very, very small thing, but the media blew it up. You would think it would be the end of the world.
No, they wouldn't do that, please.
Oh, geez. You would have thought every single Windows 10 machine in the world was self-destructing by the way the media was reporting it. But the thing was, Microsoft offered free support to help bring your files back. If anyone knows anything about computers, which most people on the podcast do, you never really delete a file. You just delete the reference to it. So there's tools out there to recover that stuff. One of my other friends who had it actually happen to him, he said, oh, just moved it to a folder on my computer, so I just moved it back. And you know, I'm like, oh well, but when it first come out, Robert, you would have seen all the things, you would have thought the world was ending, right?
Yeah, basically it had an interaction between known folder move, which is part of the OneDrive for Business synchronization option that will move your documents, pictures and so on into OneDrive to allow that to be backed up. And there was some issue around that if it was enabled in a certain set of sequence. And unfortunately, like I said, I think there are obviously a lot of people out there gunning for anything that is new, whether it is right or wrong. They simply report that as the world's falling to make clickbait. Again, this was only for those people, the seekers, as they say, the people that go out and ask for an update, ask for an update, ask for an update, and then get it. But to Microsoft's credit, it did, hold off on it. It did investigate it and now is rolling it out back through its sequence. I updated a number of machines, didn't see it myself. So again, like you said, I think there was a limited number of people that it did affect, but obviously that did cause some concern and it was easily fixed. Hopefully we're on the right path now for everyone to get the October update of Windows 10. I haven't seen it on a few of my other machines, but it's certainly, I will be trying to make sure and get those updated as soon as possible, because there are some nice features there. The new snipping tool and a number of other things that are certainly a big benefit. So again, one of the ideas here is that going to a modern desktop means that we are in this constant update cycle. Generally, I would suggest that it's beneficial keeping things up to date, especially I think when you get on the Windows 10 platform, we don't generally see a lot of issues, but obviously people want to roll it out in a staged manner. But in my experience, I haven't seen a lot of issues around the Windows 10 updates. I think once everybody gets on that platform with the appropriate hardware, it's pretty easy to then continue to update. So we're going to get glitches now and then, given the size of the Windows ecosystem, but hopefully they've been rectified. And again, Microsoft has adjusted and will be now rolling out with an updated version for everybody.
Yeah, and look, I think for most people, we've all got really complacent around backup. So most people wouldn't be affected by this. It was really people who were doing some crazy power user stuff with the My Documents file. It wasn't the everyday user. It would be very unlikely that business users would be experiencing something like this, because you don't do this sort of the sequence that you had to follow to recreate this. It was very rare to have this happen. It was far more a power user, like a gamer at home who has a small SSD and wants to store My Documents out on a bigger hard drive, for example. So, you know, from that point of view, it didn't affect me at all. One of my mates did that, but again, he's a power user, he's an IT nerd at home, and you know, he didn't run it like that in his business machine. So I think the impact was so small, it's very easy to blow these things out of proportion.
Well, I think that's why you just got to give it a bit of balance. Unfortunately, the media is not necessarily reporting, I suppose, the most balanced view. And again, one of the things that I wrote an article recently on my blog about whether one needs to update Office 365, because I've seen a lot of misinformation out there about vendors who are selling, strangely enough, backup products, who are looking to flog their wares and are going out telling basically untruths about what is backed up and how Office 365 does manage the retention of information. So I have written an article to cover that and hopefully set the record straight. And again, I'll put the link to that in the show notes. But in essence, you can be rest assured that Microsoft is backing your stuff up. And again, there are a number of ways that you can extend that beyond the default. And certainly more backups are better, and third-party backups have a place to extend what Microsoft does. So again, I think there needs to be a little bit of truth in reporting, but unfortunately the internet with clickbait and ads and all those sort of things doesn't really encourage that. But hopefully here on the podcast, we try and keep it as straight down the line as we can. What do you reckon, Breton? Are we doing that?
Yeah, I think so. I think the article that you wrote, I actually haven't read it, unfortunately. I'd like to read it. It's quite an in-depth, in-detail look at this stuff, and this information is very, very difficult to obtain because, like Robert was saying, you're going to vendors, and I'm not saying this of all vendors, but occasionally they exaggerate, and maybe some of the information that they're providing is based on things that happened a few years ago that are no longer relevant. I actually have a post on LinkedIn from 12 months ago around, but backup, and should you backup Office 365, what Microsoft does and doesn't do and that sort of thing. So I probably need to read Robert's article and run it by mine and make sure that mine's actually current and up to correct. And maybe Robert might want to go through it and tell me everything that's wrong with it.
I don't necessarily think it's wrong. I think the main thing is that, again, Office 365 does do some, obviously, some backup. It does it in a bit different way, more enterprise-focused than what we traditionally see in SMB, which is a point-in-time recovery. Also, Microsoft controls when the backup happens, where it goes through, those sort of things, which are different from the SMB style, where you put it on a USB or whatever. So there are some differences there, but you know, at the end of the day, I think there have been a lot of inaccuracies reported in order to try and sell some add-on products. So hopefully we've dispelled that, and again, I'll link to that in the show notes. So we probably should focus on some positives here. So why don't we focus on some additional news that keeps coming out even though Ignite has finished. So one of the interesting ones I saw was that Microsoft is now going to allow you to create an organizational-wide Microsoft team of up to 1,000 users. So obviously the question is, well, if you can create a team that's up to 1,000 users, what point is there for Yammer? So did you manage to see this information, Brenton?
Yeah, I'm having a look at it here as well. And I suppose that is where Yammer has traditionally played. So you want to organize the staff Christmas party and you've got 50, 60 staff. Rather than every you see seeing 60 or 70 people in an email, you spin up Yammer and you get everybody in Yammer. And then Yammer will manage the email traffic if people aren't on Yammer. If they are on Yammer, they can just do notifications and stuff like that. So I think there is a very, very clear move from Microsoft into Teams. And I think Teams is a better product in the way that it's presented as well. So Yammer didn't really take off. It doesn't really, it's a bit of a black sheep in the Office 365 environment. The aesthetics aren't the same. Whereas Teams, like you open that up and people who have used Web Outlook or used any other Microsoft product, it just looks like it should be there. And it's, if people are already using Teams, then this seems like a much natural fit, as we've seen with everything else that's been moved into Teams. Would you agree with that, Robert?
Not really. I think you'll find there are more Yammer users than there are Teams users. I think that's because Yammer's been
That's probably true.
That's been around for a long time. I think Yammer is pretty much a very focused product, mainly on conversations and getting people to interact. I think it serves a purpose across the organization. I think Teams is very good, but the way it's going with Teams is going to become the aggregation of a whole range of services. Now, that is good, but it also makes things complicated. So users, you know, they have to go to files, they have to go to tabs, they have to go where SharePoint, all that sort of stuff can complicate things. What I think I like about Yammer is it is very focused on conversations. It also has, I think, a more flexible structure when you go in and create groups and subgroups. And the good thing about Yammer is you can have private groups. We can't yet have private channels in Teams, so there are some differences, and certainly encourage people to consider it in place of, you know, in their organization. It does make sense, I think, for organizational wide. Again, it just depends, but I think, like anything, it's just another option here that whatever makes sense to your business. The smaller the business generally will go to Teams, but again, a 1,000 wide organization having Teams, yes, maybe, but I think, again, it's a matter of understanding what tool works best. And I think Yammer does a very good job for what it's worth. And in a lot of cases, the reason that people have turned away from it, especially in SMB, is because they haven't given it enough usage and they don't use it themselves. So they don't sort of understand the product. So the other side of the coin I would suggest is a lot of IT people aren't particularly social, so they're not into social tools and social networks like Yammer. So again, both have their positives and their negatives, both have their abilities, both can work inside an organization. It's up to the user, the organization, to determine what works best for them. But I'm certainly an advocate for Yammer, certainly an advocate for Teams, but I like Yammer and the fact that he's very focused just on conversations.
Yeah, and it does work quite well for that, having chat pop up and you can have a conversation with people. Like you said, the private groups, people have used Facebook, find Yammer very easy to pick up and start using. So there's a lot of advantages that Yammer brings to the table. So I definitely think it's not a big paradigm shift like Teams is. Teams/Slack, it's a completely different way of working. So there's always a bit of a transition to that. Whereas I think Yammer is pretty natural and easy to pick up and start using.
And what we're going to see is that Yammer will have a web part shortly, be able to integrate it into Teams. So I'll be able to create a tab in Teams that refers to Yammer conversations. Same in SharePoint. So again, it's just a range of tools. What makes sense? And in a simplified environment where you just want a service to do one thing, maybe you want a Yammer conversation to be corporate-wide. This is the news. These are interesting articles, or this is what we've seen in newsletters or whatever. I think that's a really good use for it. Whereas Teams, I think, are generally aimed at a group of people doing the same sort of functions like admin, HR, finance. Certainly, you can use it outside that. So again, the biggest tool that's abused most of the time that we have today is Outlook, which is used for everything under the sun. It's not a case you can't use it, but what makes the most sense for that? So that's coming. We'll put the link in the show notes for you to have a look at. Consideration, if you've got any feedback, any thoughts, let us know. We're certainly interested to see what other people say. Your experience will vary from us, from ours. Again, remember that each of these can play a role, and they don't have to play a role forever. They can be, you know, short term. I like to use Yammer as a great adoption tool. Over time, those conversations move to Teams. So again, don't think that it's a locked in forever style environment. We've also got some new capabilities for our SharePoint migration tool. So the SharePoint migration tool allows us to move data typically from on-prem into Office 365 and to SharePoint Online. It has traditionally done files very well, and now basically what it's doing is it's going to allow us to also start moving our lists, and there's also going to be some new and improved features, probably performance, I suppose, the way that we can also script it. So we can also script this tool now with PowerShell. So it means that you can set up a script to run the migrations for you as well. So again, this tool from Microsoft is free, does continue to improve in small steps, I would say. There are third-party options that are out there, but it is a good way to, again, point data from on-prem and generally file data typically and move it to Office 365, produce a number of reports, deal with errors, and so on. So again, it's something that you certainly should add to your arsenal if you are moving data from on-prem into Office 365. Make sure that you update it regularly and get all the new benefits that are coming with this tool. Have you actually used that migration tool, Breton?
No, I don't really touch SharePoint. So if a customer comes to me and says, I want SharePoint, people who will remember Al, who was on the podcast, or maybe we haven't run that episode yet, he talks a lot about SharePoint. That's his business. So I hand that sort of stuff over to him and go, I don't need another thing to worry about. Can you help this customer migrate? So he's been going through a process with a customer at the moment where he's migrating him from a version that's not even like a 2000 something. It's from before that. Robert will know more about it than I do. And migrating him up through all the versions. They're not quite ready to go online. But he says the sooner they can get it online, the better. So tools like this that Microsoft's bringing out, typically you have to go out and buy a very expensive tool to do this. Microsoft's now giving you a free, simple, fast solution, as they say in their marketing material, that can be driven with PowerShell. So Robert will be a fan of it.
Definitely. Love me PowerShell. Some other things that we've seen in the AD space is that we've now got the ability to actually go in and clean up the local AD once we put in Azure AD Connect. So that health of the local AD will be reported back into the portal in Azure, so you can go in and start looking and seeing if there are any errors in your local AD. We also recommend that they use the tool beforehand to make sure your AD is as clean as possible, because we don't want junk going into the Office 365 and the Azure AD. So there is a, I can't remember what the tool is now. ID Fix, I think, is the tool that you can run, free tool from Microsoft, to check your AD, make sure that you haven't got duplicate attributes and things like that. The other thing that they noted for us is that they're also bringing the ability to do two-factor authentication back down to Windows 7 machines now and Windows 8. So this will allow people who are still running those out-of-date environments to use Azure AD and multi-factor authentication to make sure those logins are still secure. So again, that's going to be really good. And again, it shows Microsoft's commitment to bringing everybody up, or improving the security overall, and making sure that we have the ability, no matter where the users are, to use two-factor authentication, which is really going to reduce the vast majority, 99% probably, of phishing attacks in our environments.
Yeah, well, Google rolled out hardware 2FA, and they essentially eliminated phishing from Google. So Microsoft's obviously doing it with a software solution, but there's no reason why you can't use a hardware solution. A YubiKey or something like that is totally compatible with that. So yeah, it's good that even though these versions of Windows, Microsoft's not thrilled about having to support, and is really doing a big push to get you onto Windows 10. That's a secure version of Windows. That's the best version of Windows. They understand that some businesses, they're still transitioning away from Windows 8. They're still transitioning away from Windows 7. They're offering, we talked about last time on the podcast, where you can have your desktop in the cloud with Windows 7, and that way they can support that sort of stuff a little bit easier than if you're running disparate hardware and whatever. So it's really good. There's not a lot of software vendors out there that will just, you know, provide this level of support to a product that's, well, when did Windows 7 come out, you know, like it's out of feature support now, so it's been out for that long. Yeah, so it's a positive thing, I think, and yeah, we're quite lucky.
Yeah, I think, again, it indicates the commitment that needs to be made to security, and simple things can make big differences. So we certainly encourage people to use multi-factor authentication on all their logins. They can do it on consumer accounts now and also their business accounts, and makes everything much more secure. And it's a bit more of a pain, but that's the idea, is to make things as secure or more secure than what it is normally, make it more difficult for somebody if the credentials are lost. And certainly some of the Microsoft tools that are now coming out are making it very much easier for users. All they need to do basically is accept something on their phone and they are logged in without even having to type a password in there. So I think that we probably need to look at rounding this up so we can get into our interview for this episode. So I think, Brent, you did this one for us. Why don't you give us a bit of background on what we can expect in the upcoming interview in the second part?
Yeah, so Lorenzo runs a company called Glue. And before that, he used to run a company called City Software, which at its height was doing $50 million turnover of hardware and software. So he's got a lot of insight around, and he's been doing it for a long, long time too. So he's sort of got 30 years experience in the space. He's more of a business guy than a tech guy. So if you guys like those sort of businessy sort of conversations, he's a really, really interesting person to talk to. So he just sort of talks how the hardware environment has changed and where he thinks it's going and what sorts of things you can do if you sell hardware to help improve how your business runs. So I think it'll be a good one. I'd love to hear your feedback about it. I think the audio could have been better because we did it over the internet and whatever, but it's not too bad. So check it out.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll make sure that that's in the episode along with any show notes from that episode. You can keep up to date with the podcast at N2K Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook. Send us an email, feedback@needtoknow.cloud. And remember, you can contact Brenton at contactbrenton on Twitter and myself at directorcia. We've also, again, encouraged people to let us know what sort of guests you'd like to have, what topics you'd like to see covered, if we're hitting the topics that you want to see. And again, we welcome all feedback. But I think with that, unless you've got something else you want to add, Brenton, I think it's time that we wrap up this episode.
Lorenzo is a co-founder of Glue, which is a cloud-based tool that simplifies quoting an IT supply for IT service providers. Lorenzo is helping businesses like yours get into the $6 billion industry, which is IT hardware in Australia. The reason I bring Lorenzo on today is everyone who knows me on the podcast knows that I'm cloud, 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 cloud. And before I met Lorenzo, I occasionally sold hardware, but I would really avoid doing it. And, quite often send my customer down to JB or, you know, wherever to go get their stuff. But after meeting Lorenzo, I realized that, you know, you're leaving a lot of money on the table. You're making it harder for your customer to actually get their IT needs met because they're working with multiple suppliers, particularly ones that don't know what they're talking about. And it's not a great way of, you know, controlling the customer experience end to end. So I asked Lorenzo if he'd come onto the podcast and pass on some of the wisdom that he's been able to give me over the time. We've worked quite closely together over the last 3-4 months, and he's taught me a lot that I just didn't have any idea about before. So I thought, what a great person to bring on, and maybe he can teach you a little bit about how all the industry works and what the opportunity is out there for businesses like yours. So hello Lorenzo, how are you today?
Very good, Brenton. I'm very pleased to be here, and hello listeners.
That's excellent. All right, well, let's get started. So I've got a few questions for you today. The first question I want to ask you is around, you know, how did Glue come to be? You're the co-founder of Glue. You've got another co-founder as well, Andrew. Can you tell us a little bit about the story about how did Glue, so that's GLUH.co, came to be?
Yeah, and Glue is the German word for to glow. So, and it's spelt with the umlaut ordinarily, but the website's gluh.co. Well, we've been selling IT products through my business since 1991, and we sold a lot of product to particularly the small to medium business market space. We had around 64,000 businesses buying from us on at least a semi-regular basis, and most of those had an IT service provider. And really, we built our business on the back of a very efficient process in selling product and in effect connecting all the products that are available in the supply chain to those businesses who want to buy them. So over several cycles of growth in the business, we came to a point where we started asking ourselves, well, what really is the purpose of our business? These customers which we want to serve with the best technology products that are available in the channel, where do they actually really want to buy their products from? And so, Brenton, that's where we came to the conclusion, slowly but surely, that they actually want to buy these products from the IT service provider that looks after them. And so that's when we started having a good hard look around the competencies of our organisation. And the business grew. Since 1991, we were the first company to take credit card payments over the telephone. That company was City Software, and that enabled us to dispatch goods out of a warehouse the same day, because in effect we got payment same day. And back in 1991, that was not a common thing. Nobody made a payment over the credit card with a credit card over the telephone. And that led to...
Yeah, and what was the alternative to payments then? What, send you a check, go in and pay with cash? Was there any other easy way of transacting with you? Have an account, I guess?
Yeah, back then in the 80s and early 90s, there were quite a lot of computer shops and it still is today. But also software was predominantly sold through a myriad of software specialist stores, as well as other hardware retail stores that sold software on the side. And so you really had to leave your business, go to a shop and buy something that may or may not be on a shelf and pay a retail price for it. So those were that have been around at that time will remember that. It was not a great service. So it was quite revolutionary to be able to phone somebody up, pay with a credit card over the phone, and it was dispatched that day. And if you were ordered in the morning, you'd receive the goods the same day. So that was a bit of a cracker at the time. The business grew enormously. We sold over a million in product in our first year since the inception, and we sold 4.3 million in product in the second year, and it just grew and grew and grew. Then we started hearing about the internet becoming a thing, and in 1994 we launched our first website, which was really a nice price list of products. And nobody in Australia that we could find knew how to develop a website, so we flew a journalist over to the Silicon Valley, and that's when we heard about this SQL server system that was in pre-release at that time, and we managed to get a copy of that, and that is the first incarnation of what today is Glue.
Oh wow, so it started all the way back there in 1994 and the birth of the internet in Australia, and and to basically drive the business. So it wasn't just something you said, oh, there's a need out in the market, we'll build something to cater for that need. It was really you trying to solve your own problem, and it's evolved over 20 years, so more than that now, but it's closer to 25.
Yeah, absolutely. So it started off basically with most orders occurring by over the telephone or through a fax machine. There wasn't even email, was not really a thing back then. And we felt that online was just another interface, another method by which people will buy from. And so we thought we'd get on that bandwagon very early. Now, we also had a system which I inherited from a company in Germany that was DBase-based, that managed the whole sales process. And that was integrated to this SQL Server e-commerce. Oh, well, it wasn't e-commerce back then, but an online price list. We started experimenting around supplier feeds, which didn't exist in the 90s, but we did import spreadsheets into the DBase system, which replicated across to the website. And by 1998, those two systems were fully integrated. You could see live pricing and availability. So if you did ring up the call center, for example, and buy something, you could watch stock go down by one. And I'm sure there's many listeners out there that remember that service from City Software that was known for speed and reliability and a decent price point. So this...
Yeah, well, you're very well known in the industry. I reckon all of our listeners will know who you are, or at least know the business that you're talking about. I'm just cognizant of time that we have to keep moving fairly forward. So fast forward to today, you've started to build the system at City Software, you've got it up and going, it's working really well, it's turned into a website where people can go and purchase stuff, and they can see the stock go up, and you can see the stock go up and down as new stock comes in. There's a step in between that before it became what it is today with the drop shipping stuff.
Yeah, so basically the IT service provider today is rarely, if ever, profitable with selling products. Their whole business model is around selling their services and engineering their business around monthly recurring revenue, which is a fantastic business model, and quite clearly how ours operates as well. And we're fully supportive of that. However, what that means, though, is that most IT service providers really just focused on a core range of products. It was all about replicatable solutions. And the whole quoting and procurement process is quite clumsy. And this is something that we noticed is the core reason why businesses were buying from my former company, is because when they had, for example, their printer die and they want a replacement printer, they would ring up their IT service provider and they would say, look, go to Officeworks and buy whatever you like, but we don't really do printers. Well, that's not what their customer really wanted to hear in a perfect world, but it's understandable why an IT service provider won't spend an hour or two hunting around for that product and back and forth quoting. Their next phone call might have been to a company like ours, and we could advise them on the spot and take their credit card details and ship the goods straight out of the wholesaler, drop ship it to their business location for their IT service provider to install the next day. And that's largely what our business was built around. So we considered that if we made our, what was already a SaaS platform, multi-tenanted and put the brand on of the IT service provider, much like you set your business up in Xero, then they can do what we used to do. So the IT service provider then could take that phone call and instantly, without even quoting, take the sale, put it on the customer's account and have their service tech there in the morning, so they make the margin. So what this means then for the customer experience is that they don't have to send somebody down to Officeworks who's going to talk to some kid and sell them the $299 special that's going on at the moment. They're going to sell an $850 product that is the proper printer that they should buy. It'll actually be cheaper to run over 3 years, and they're going to be much less frustrated than the alternative that they would have otherwise bought. So it's a superiorly or an enhanced experience for the customer. They got the right technology in their place, and it was much more convenient, and it's a greater brand engagement with your customer, because one measurement of brand engagement is how much the customer spends with you. So your revenues go up, your margins go up, and because the whole process took you inside of 2 minutes, you're making money.
Yeah, well, I think of time before Glue, and you know, for the listeners out there, I forgot to mention what drop shipping actually is. Drop shipping's not when you store inventory, it's when you let the distributor store the inventory and manage the shipping for you, and you just sell the product and send the order, and then they send the order direct to the customer. So you don't have the whole retail storefront headaches of trying to manage, you know, $100,000 or $1 million of inventory in your shop and a warehouse and all of that. You basically just put the order through to Ingram or whoever, and then they ship it directly to the customer. So that's basically the mechanism which allows this whole product to work. Because if we had to keep, you know, 50 printers in stock, there's just no way. Like, I would never do that. So that's one of the really interesting parts of this. Did you have something to say on that?
Yeah, we pioneered dropship back with Tech Pacific back then, before it became Ingram Micro, and Kerry Bailey supported the program where we paid TechPack $10 per consignment, and in effect their inventory became our inventory, and our revenues over an 18-month period doubled in that period. And we see similar results with IT service providers who utilize Glue. There are some IT service providers, although it's not typical, some of them have nearly doubled their revenue in a 1 year to 18-month period. More typically, it's more like 30% increase. It really depends to the level that you decide to engage with the system. But when you sell more product, you sell more services, because there's more stuff to service.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a good segue into my next question about what is the opportunity today for IT service providers? What are the numbers? How do we make money in this space?
Yeah, it's a huge opportunity. There's $6 to $7 billion of IT products sold through retail, including online retail in Australia, and a big percentage of that is to businesses. And I believe that if you put all IT service providers in the SMB market space, that market space in Australia together, they're not even making up $1 billion of product revenue. So it is most certainly disproportionate. And when you look at the evolution of the industry, going from selling a PC for $3,000 where you've made 1,000 GP on it, giving away your services, to that vendor land crunching the margins down to very little, it's understandable why the IT service provider evolved into a services business model. But we think that will change, because it's not what's best for the industry. And ultimately, if you provide the right tools in the hands of the MSP to be able to do the right thing and the best thing for their client, I believe that there's a new equilibrium that will come into the marketplace. So it's not necessarily taking all that market away from retail. there's a lot more incremental business that businesses will buy, particularly the SMB market space, because it's easy to obtain and it can be implemented. It's wonderful hearing about a product, but then you don't know how to implement it because the IT service provider doesn't sell it, and you're not really going to buy it from a retailer. So I believe that there's a natural evolution in the industry to the extent that we bid our whole business on it and sold the business and got behind the IT service provider to multiply, in effect, what we were doing beforehand through the channel of the MSPs. So it's a very big industry, and our service is new to the market. We came to the market in March last year, and there's a very large increase in companies signing up with Glue and trialing it. It's a free trial, so it's very simple to engage with Glue, and you can go to glue.co and just sign up for a free trial, and we configure all your supplier feeds and branding and so forth on the system, and it only takes an hour to do the final integrations into ConnectWise, Autotask or Xero, and get trained on the system as well. And it's so intuitive to use that once you've seen a transaction go through the system from beginning to end, including the procurement, you find the penny drops, and it's a bit like when the iPhone came out for the first time. You see how a phone call's made, and then you realise that you just click on stuff and it works. So it's designed so that you can't stuff up a transaction. It's really, to be profitable, there's two key factors around profitability of a transactional sale like that. Firstly, and most importantly, is reliability of transaction. If you have to rework a transaction, it usually takes you 10 times longer to fix something than getting it right in the first place. And most MSPs are reworking somewhere between 10 and 20% of their transactions. So that means half their time is spent on transactions that the customer's not even happy about. And no wonder that develops the wrong culture within the organisation, because it's just simply not fun listening how things gone wrong and then finding out why the courier didn't deliver, or why the SSD for that device not turn up and the engineers twiddling their thumbs. Well, Glue eliminates a lot of that in our own business, and that was a very high transactional volume of more than 10,000 transactions for most months. We were running at a rework rate of somewhere between 2.7 and 3.2% of transactions. And the second one is speed of transaction. If you have to hunt around for a product for an hour or two, quote it up back and forth and so forth, you miss the opportunity. Whereas if you can do it on the phone straight away in 1 to 2 minutes, quite literally, or you can just email the customer back with a hyperlink on your e-commerce site and say, look, any of these notebooks will do, take your pick and buy whatever you like and let the customer choose, and there are some customers that expect to buy that way, then the system will facilitate that very easily. And so they're the two key factors around profitability transaction and ensuring that every time that you're paying for something, that your accounts payable ledger is actually correct. It's at the price you've ordered it for. It hasn't been double shipped or anything like that. The integrity of the system and integrity of transaction is managed by Glue.
Yeah. And one of the good things I've found about Glue is because you put all the suppliers in, so you have in your own website, you have access to, you know, stock, whether it's in stock and how much it's in stock. So if you want to buy a monitor for a customer, it will tell you what's in stock, where the cheapest price is from all the suppliers that you have a relationship with. So I have a relationship with about 5 or 6 different suppliers that will buy stuff off. We got a primary supplier that we generally like to buy things off. But it makes that whole process really, really seamless. And I suppose there's some opportunity around margin and stuff, but from a customer experience point of view, them being able to call up, say, I need a monitor, and you have a look and say, what'd they buy last time? Did you like that monitor we bought last time? Yeah, I like the 27-inch size. Oh, if we could get you one of those for $350, would you be happy with that? Yep, I'll just see who's got it in stock. All right, we've just put the order through. That's been charged to your credit card, and you know, we'll come around and set it up in the next couple of days for you. And, you know, they're overwhelmed with that experience rather than, like you were saying, the traditional back and forwards.
Well, absolutely. And the a lot of MSPs worry that they've got to be the cheapest price in town, and that's not true at all. We're seeing blended margins for MSPs being predominantly in the 18 to 22 points range, which is a good margin. It's actually less than what retailers are doing, but nonetheless, it's a good margin when you consider how much work it is to perform the transaction. And when you need a car part for a repair in your car, you don't go shopping around for that part for the cheapest thing. You just get your mechanic to buy it and put it in. A lot of businesses think the same way. They're looking for the expertise and advice that they're buying the right product and not walking back with a shiny notebook from a retailer which has got then Windows Home on, and it's a disappointing experience to upgrade it, and cost, of course. It's not the ideal experience. So businesses, people in business and small to medium businesses, they're smart people, and they know that you're not necessarily going to be the cheapest price, but it's the best value proposition that you're offering the customer, not necessarily a cheaper dollar value.
Yeah, well, they've all gone down to Officeworks and asked the guy down there, you know, what do I buy? And he goes, oh, this is on special. It's, you know, oh, wouldn't you like to ask me about six questions about my environment first before you recommend something? They're not really consultative salespeople. They're transactional salespeople. So it's very different to an MSP that says, oh, no, you have to have BitLocker. You have to be able to connect it to domain join. You need Azure AD domain join, so we need to make sure that's on there. All right, we're going to purchase. We've got a couple of options here. Would you like a smaller form factor or a larger screen, desktop or a laptop? All right, great. Let's get this one based on this being there. Oh, you're the CEO. All right, let's get you something a little bit more fancy with all the options on it. Oh, it's a trainee coming in. You don't want to spend a lot of money. That's great. Let's get our base model in business class. And so you can do all of that, where down at JB Hi-Fi, they don't know the person in front of them at all. It's just another person coming in. It's great when grandma needs to buy a laptop or something, but it's not great for businesses who need a far more consultative approach to the way that they purchase and procure things.
Yeah, that's a very important point. Retailers are well known to stack it high and let them fly, but with all your supplier feeds and the full availability of what's in the channel, you have a larger product range at your fingertips than the retailers do. So you can sell a more specialized product more easily to that customer of yours. And in fact, not just the traditional, you know, the owner who's sitting around late at night quoting things up. Anyone in your organization can quote things up and not have to have access to the supplier portals. It's all managed automatically from Glue. So we're finding that even engineers who traditionally hate selling, because negotiating price points and delivery costs and all that sort of thing, that's kind of like a dirty word, don't want to have to do all of that. But if the system automatically tells you if there's bid pricing or a special negotiated price, or this is the pricing structure that the customer's on, so all they have to do is select a customer and put all the stuff in a basket and sell it, well, they'll do that. And they certainly also won't go hunting around supplier portals and spend an hour looking for something. But if they can do it in a minute or two, even on their mobile phone while they're at the client site, the engineers are very trusted by businesses, because they're not your polished salesperson, but they are very knowledgeable of the products, and as a consequence, they're trusted by the owners of businesses. If they say that this is the better way to go, they know they're not incentivized on the dollar's gross profit in a product. What they're incentivized on is making the technology work at the customer, and it's the right motivation to sell. So there's a lot of reasons why this is transformative, very transformative, and it's actually hard to understand until you actually try it out. That's why we do the free trial and do the work on the background to make it such a simple experience, because it's the puppy dog sale. Once you see it in action, you never want to give up the system.
Yeah. Look, I find it to be quite easy to use, and I'm very, very critical of SaaS applications, because I live and breathe in SaaS applications all day, every day. Even Robert might get a little bit annoyed that you know, I'm a little bit critical of Microsoft at times. So I think, yeah, if you get in there, you see if it works. I find it really easy to go in there, even just for checking stock, you know, how much stock have we got in this? But I've been caught with that too. And I rang Lorenzo up and I said there was 140 at the beginning of the day and there's zero today. What happened? What happened in that case? Well, what do you reckon happened there?
Well, it's a rarer scenario, but on occasion retailers will snap up all the stock that's available in the channel. And so if you're selling a notebook or something that retailers are after, you could find stock levels disappear quite quickly. So yeah, that does happen on occasion, but as I said, your rework rate on a transaction is very low. You'd find out quickly that this thing has not been dispatched from the supplier and find an alternative. So I think
and you know you've got the data in just about real time anyway, so that's one of the good things about it. Rather than a spreadsheet you might keep on your computer, you actually have all logging into the stupid vendor portals and going into three or four of them to see who's got stock, and you try and do a multiple order and you can get a monitor from them but not the computer, and then a computer from someone else but they don't have the mice the customer wants because they want all the same mice as what they have, you know. That's the sort of challenge that I find this really excels at, because it has it all in there. It will just put it together and tell you, it will actually go out and purchase it all for you if you want to set it up that sophisticated. But it will tell you who's got stock in all of these places. So you're never trying to ring around who's got stock. Most of the time it's pretty straightforward.
Well, and the automatic procurement engine will figure out based on your supplier preferences on a more complex transaction. It'll go through even millions of permutations to work out optimize supply based on a lot of criteria. That comes out of the box. So we're finding that in this migration of the industry into the information age, there is a substantial opportunity for IT service providers to set up the business clients of theirs with technology that will enable them to be more competitive and leverage off these technologies that are emerging and bringing us into this digital age. And with the digital age, naturally, SaaS applications are a big thing, but so too is product. There are physical products that people run their business on, and there's more and more products being sold today than ever before. And that range of products will only increase, especially with the Internet of Things emerging, but other computers do more and more things that they didn't do once upon a time. So it's a challenging environment for the IT service provider. I think it's great fun when you've got the best tools in your hands to do that. And we provide SaaS applications for our clients, and I think as an industry, we need to drink our own champagne. And we need to utilize SaaS applications ourselves. And Glue is one of those applications that I believe is a very important part in your service offering, so that your customer experience is at the cutting edge of what it can be in the evolving industry going forward.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, this whole thing about hardware dying, hardware is changing. And that's one of the things that Robert and I talk about a lot on the podcast, is that it's useless trying to do device-based security, because the security follows the user now. They don't just have one computer at work and they go in and sit in front of the computer at work. Sometimes they do, but if we're talking about modern workplace, they'll have a phone, they'll have a laptop, they'll have a desktop in the office, maybe they'll have they have all these different devices, IoT, smartwatches, etc. So the actual hardware stuff is people are having 2, 3, 4 devices more often than not. We've got a great challenge in the cloud and how we secure and manage all of those devices, but there's a revenue opportunity as well, saying, okay, well, let's make sure we get everyone on the same platform, for example, or can we buy them for the customer, make sure they have the right stuff, so we're not trying to put together a really convoluted solution on the cloud side to try and make it all work together, because all the stuff's the wrong stuff, because we told the customer buy this and they bought the wrong thing, and yeah, you know how it all is. Anyway, I think it's time to wrap it up. So just before we go, I thought, is there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with today, Lorenzo?
I'd like to encourage the listeners to be open-minded to opening up their business to be able to sell a wider range of products, that it's not as scary as it sounds. We have solved that problem, and this is not a startup system that's still working itself out. It is a very accomplished and stable platform that's hosted in Azure and built very well in the .NET platform. So you're not married to any long-term contracts, so it's a month-by-month subscription like a lot of SaaS platforms like Xero. And, you know, we want to partner with you. You leverage off our experience and know-how how to make this work in the real world. So we don't just hand you the keys, log into a platform and good luck to you. We have extensive experience and relationships in the channel, and we'll hold your hand through the types of things that you need to think through for this to be successful. And it's much more simple than you think. So I wish the listeners on this podcast the very best over the next season in this industry that we're embarking in. Keep increasing your monthly recurring revenue with that client base. There's so much opportunity there. And selling product will actually assist in growing that revenue, as many MSPs in the meantime have found out. So I hope to hear from you at some stage and serve you so that you can serve your customers even better.
Yeah, look, I'm always happy to take a phone call too, or if you hit me up on Twitter or whatever and you want to ask me how I found the product, I'm brutally honest about how I find the product. My store's set up at procurement.uptakedigital.com.au, so if you want to jump on there and have a bit of a play with it and see how it all works, that's always an option. There's a demo on the Glue site as well. I think it's just demo.gluh.co.
That's right.
Is that correct, Lorenzo?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So you can have a look at their demo. Their demo is better than my site, actually. But yeah, look, I got it up and going in a couple of hours, and it was working. It still works quite well. I haven't had any too many issues with it. So anyway, that's it for today. I'll wish Lorenzo all the very best with his business. What we might do one day is get Robert to interview Andrew and do a bit of a deep dive in how he makes all the Azure magic work. Andrew's one of those gifted developers, those A players that Steve Jobs kept talking about. So he'd be a good person to have on from a technical standpoint. But thank you very much for coming on today, Lorenzo. And I'll sign out. You can say goodbye as we sign out.
Thank you very much, Brendan. I appreciate the opportunity to share.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.